back to the Punished Podcast, the official podcast of PunishedBacklog.com. My name is Sam Martinelli, pronouns he, him, and I'm an editor at the Punished Backlog. For this episode, we're going to be talking about retro games and retro gaming in general. Some topics that we want to dive into are, what makes a game retro? Is it just age, or is it something else? Is it vibes? What role does retro gaming play in our lives and in the broader gaming atmosphere? Also, towards the end of the episode, we'll have a fun little game of Who You Got, Retro Edition, to spice things up a little bit. We have a number of awesome folks here for this episode, so why don't we go around and share name, pronouns, and a retro game, up to your interpretation for what that means, that you particularly like or just want to highlight.
I'll go first. My name is Amanda Tian, pronouns she, her, or they. And a retro game that I love is Galaga, like a kind of a classic arcade game. I love the like pew, 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 like sliding around. And I remember it was one of the first games at an arcade that my dad told me that like he had really loved as a kid too. And like that was really special. And I have another memory of it is that Spy Fox, a great, great educational, like kind of era games. Yeah. The class, we were discussing humongous games in the chat the other day. Spy Fox Dry Cereal had a mini game which was like Galaga, and I remember playing that for like a year with my mom and my sister. Like our goal was to beat like level 100, and so it just like that action of Galaga in general is I'm just very fond of it. Very straightforward but still exciting at all times.
What's up, everybody? My name is Vaughn Hunt, he, him. My retro game I'll shout out is Brave Fencer Musashi. You know, it's one of the first retro games. Yeah.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah, one of the first games I rented multiple times from Hollywood Video, which is obviously defunct. Yeah, great game. It's so retro. There's action figures in the game, and I feel like action figures, you know, have not had a strong, mind place in current culture.
Hey, everyone. David Silbert, he, him, and I will go with The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. Not my favorite Zelda game, but when I think of early Saturday mornings playing old games from the past, or yeah, they were old, they were retro even when I was playing them, that one is definitely top of mind for me. And then I'll also do maybe Final Fantasy VII as another shout out. Those are both like prime Saturday morning, you know, plug in the emulator or the PS3 or whatever, and play some games that I wasn't around long enough to appreciate when they came out.
What about you, Sam?
All right. Well, I mean, I got a million retro games. I actually was, Amanda, I was thinking about saying Galaga too, because that's however, I'm actually going to go a different direction, go slightly older. With Space Invaders.
Nice, yes.
And it's a game, I wouldn't say it's a particularly special game to me, but apparently before my brother and I were born, my parents did own an Atari 2600.
Ooh.
And my dad would just play the hell out of Space Invaders. And it's like, he doesn't really play video games anything anymore, but like, he said that was the game he got really into, he couldn't stop. So they always understood, even if they didn't like that I played so many video games, that they get it. They're like, we had one of these things. It can be a time suck.
That's awesome.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break and then get back into the bigger discussion. And we're back. Today's topic is retro games and retro gaming as a whole, a subject near and dear to my heart as the Punished Backlog's resident old games guy. As much as gamers constantly look to the future for the newest and coolest experiences, revisiting and revering the past remains a crucial part of gaming culture. When I was growing up, the difference between what was modern versus retro was fairly stark and easy to identify. Pixelated 2D arcade games or blocky early 3D titles were easy to call old and retro, or in some ways, dated, a term that I don't love, but we can get back to that later, as opposed to things like Mass Effect, Skyrim, Gears of War, which were clearly, you know, those were modern games when I was growing up. That they felt like nothing else could have existed before that. Like that was, but as time has gone on, the lines have blurred. As it still feels weird to call games from the mid to late 2000s retro when they're not quite as different from their modern counterparts. And I just want to add, the inspiration for this podcast topic was me telling Amanda a couple years ago that the first Mass Effect game, I guess now, is older than the Super Nintendo was when Mass Effect came out.
Yeah, that made me physically ill. Like, I was just like, don't say that. Like, don't do it.
That's the thing. Does that mean Mass Effect has to be retro? Or is it now that because a game like Mass Effect could come out now and wouldn't feel too out of place. But so that's why I want to start with, how would you all define the term retro? What are some examples of that? And how often do you play games that you consider retro? Dave, what do you guys say?
Yeah, I think you actually kicked us off in a great direction, Sam, because I wasn't sure what my answer was going to be heading into the podcast. But when you said, you know, growing up, it was easy to identify because of such the sheer shift in graphical quality from like 8 and 16 bit to polygonal, you know, early 3D models and then so on and so forth. I think it's retro doesn't have to just be like a style or like an art. When games are concerned, I think anything that's feels retro, whether it's like a certain kind of genre or gameplay mechanic, things that feel a little more antiquated or obsolete. You're not gonna like the term obsolete, but an example would be like the Wii. Motion controls are still like, you can still use them on a Switch, but most Switch games don't take advantage of those capabilities. And I imagine the Switch 2 will get even farther from that. So when I look back at something like the Wii, I mean, it's over, what, 15, 17 plus years old?
19 years old this year.
Yeah, so yeah, I was even farther off. That, I think, would count as retro. Yeah,
do some stretching in the morning, guys.
Yeah, we're old. I feel like anything that just feels like a snapshot of where gaming was, and if we've really gone far enough away from it, that is in the territory of being retro, but maybe it's just a starting point. Not sure where to go from there.
You know, that's interesting because when Sam had brought it up, he was framing it as this thing of like, X amount of years, does that equal retro? Because to me, even David, when you were saying games that reminded you of retro, I would definitely say those were sort of old school, but to me, they didn't think of as retro. I have a very 1980s aesthetic idea of retro. Like, retro is big CRT arcade boxes. Like, you go to the arcade and there are these big standalone booths for Atari and Pac-Man, and it's Pong, and you know, it's beep boop beep boop, the little pixels, you know, like where you can see every little blocky pixel. To me, that's still in my mind of what retro games are, and I feel very odd like trying to define anything from the 2000s as retro. And maybe that's just my age and maturity showing of being like, oh, has it really been 10 years since blank? Has it really been 20 years since blank? Like, but I don't know. Like, to me, retro games are sort of defined in a pulp culture lens. But I don't know. I see kids walking around doing like vintage aesthetic that looks like what I wore growing up in the early, like late 90s, early 2000s, and it makes me feel really old. And they're like, yeah, I'm doing a vibe. And I'm like, that's my culture. Don't do that.
My culture is not your costume. Is that what
yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's like Delia is like, you know, it's like Claire's earrings. And I'm like, that was my life.
I was going to say Claire's is a vibe for sure.
The Claire's, the Delia's, the like, oh, the jeans. Oh, I just, it makes me feel ancient. So it might also just be a certain reticence I have, but that's my definition of retro.
Yeah. Amber Crombie is back, you know.
Like, I know, it's crazy.
I feel like retro, anything I feel like before Wi-Fi, like, you know, before consoles had Wi-Fi, can be considered retro.
That's a really good definition.
Like, if I had to plug in, you know, like an Ethernet cable to play, and I was probably like 8 years old when people were doing that, like, it wasn't happening. There was no internet play for me. I remember I have like Ratchet and Clank Up Your Arsenal. I hopped in that internet lobby every time just to play around, but I never actually played, right? Like, it wasn't going to happen, so. Yeah, 2D sprites, or those early polygons. They don't look great today, but yeah, that's anything retro.
Hey, some of those polygons look incredible, man. Wipeout on PS1?
Yeah. Honestly, Wipeout, yeah, it looks good, honestly.
Yeah, I guess, like, I think about this all the time. To me, there is no perfect, clean way to define retro anymore. And I think if I had to boil it down to, like, one sentence, it's simply not just like, would this game get made now, but like, if someone had this idea for this game now, what would it look like? So, for example, Metal Gear Solid. if Metal Gear Solid never happened and someone had that idea now, it would not be top down. You know what I mean? It would not be you have to hold a button to go in first person, but you can't actually take out your gun when you do that. Like, it's things like that. It's not, you just press the square button a bunch of random times to fight somebody. But that also extends a little further. It's like David was mentioning the Wii. Like, if someone had the idea for Mario Galaxy now, they wouldn't need motion controls for that. Why would you? And like, that feels retro in another way. Even though, again, that came out the same year as Mass Effect, which doesn't actually feel that retro. That doesn't feel that old. I mean, it's clunky, but it was clunky then. Like, everyone's like, yeah, this game rules, just the shooting sucks. 9.5 out of 10.
Yeah. What I'm hearing is that Mass Effect is the game of a generation. It's a defining, amazing, excellent bit of content that is continually defined time and space. That's what I'm hearing.
One of the examples I was throwing up was Gears of War. Gears of War 1, I played it again like last year. It still feels like a game that we made mostly the same way now.
Yeah.
It's not like that. Either that game was way ahead of its time or the sadder, darker possibility, which is games haven't really advanced as much as we want them to.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things where, like, when I play, I use Metal Gear Solid as an example, but like, even Nintendo, like when they make a new 2D Mario game, it doesn't play like Super Mario Land 2. It doesn't play like Super Mario World. It's much smoother. There's much less friction. There's wall jumping. There's more icons on screen, more collectibles, like just these little things where you could design a 2D game to be played through in 2 hours, and the point was you played through it multiple times. You couldn't do that and sell it for $60 now. Like, that's just not happening. Dave, you got some thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, so to bring it back to the space talk, I like your added definition, Sam. I think what we're getting at is like the idea of limitations on either the technical capabilities of the hardware or the graphics or some element of the design back in the day. And also maybe something was a fad, like to use Super Mario Galaxy. I don't think it was that Nintendo was like, we need to have pointer controls to pick up all the star things. Like, you could have done that by just walking over them, or they could have had some other mechanic, right? It's Nintendo. They're crafty. But they wanted to be new and unique. So I'm torn on whether I'm like, is that in and of itself? I'm going to go back on my old, like, do I think that that's retro? I don't know. But I definitely think something like Final Fantasy VII, I know it's not that arcade, era that you were mentioning, Amanda. But when we look at the capabilities of the original VII and how much more detailed the recent remake games have been because of, additional graphical capabilities, that firmly, like, I can't look at VII. I can't play it the same way without being like, yeah, this feels old. This feels old in a good way, but it definitely feels retro to me because of how much more detail we've been able to get in the decades since.
Yeah, maybe then retro, which makes sense, that retro becomes a little bit of that eye of the beholder, which is relevant. Like, Sam and David, both to points that you're saying that it's, If it feels right, like that old quote, like if it, like, I don't know how to define pornography, but I'll know it when I see it. It's sort of like with retro, it's like, yeah, if it feels old, then it's kind of old. Like I'll give a shout out to my friend Mackie, who has listened to this podcast, and he knows I love the Mass Effect series. And I saw him recently and he goes, yeah, I started playing because you loved it so much. And I was like, thanks. Oh my God, that means so much to me. And he's like, yeah, but I really wasn't vibing with the combat on 1, it was just like really weak. And then 2, like, I don't know, I just wasn't that into it. So I started with 3 and I was like, what are you doing? Why would you do that?
You're just that's psycho core. Shit, man.
Psycho. I love you, Mackie, but that was insane. And you know it. But it was one of those things where I was just like, yeah, like some of this stuff just isn't holding up. Like, I played Dishonored, all of the Dishonored games. I replayed them a couple years ago. And the first Dishonored came out 2012. That game is amazing. Like, it's still smooth. It's still exciting. It's still interesting. Still excellent. My husband is playing Ghost of Tsushima, is loving it. That came out a couple of years ago. And so I wonder if some of it is like Final Fantasy VII in particular, like where the game feels like this is old. Like, and like, I just, maybe it's just more of a feeling. Well, Vaughn, like, you're really into fighting games, and like that is an interesting like genre with its own subgenres. Where do you think that retro comes into play with that genre?
Oh, that's you trying to open Pandora's box early in this podcast. Yeah, I feel like with fighting games, it's a little different, right? So like, you know, 2D fighters have never gone away, and you know, we love that, but I feel like the speed at which you play them has changed. Like, I don't know if anyone's played a Mortal Kombat 1 in the arcade recently, or Soul Calibur, but like the speed at which they play is a lot slower than like you remember them. Like, even Mortal Kombat 2 is slow, and then you jump forward probably like 4 or 5 years, and the game's like, okay, this is the speed I can play at, right? This is reasonable. And I'm a big Tekken fan, like same thing. Like, Tekken 1 and 2, love them for what they did for the series, but like, don't hand that to me. Put in Tekken 3. You know, we start at 3 in my mind. You know, that's right. the fine line. But I feel like for fighting games, it's more of the, what is the game that defined that series? And then every game after that feels good. Every game before that feels dated. So it's a little different in my mind. I'm sure
you're I largely agree with you. I mean, I'm not as much of a connoisseur of fighting games as you are, but I play a lot of them. I'm not very good. But like, I played Street Fighter VI a lot when it came out. I love that game. And like, it simplifies the controls. And you're right, it's not actually a very fast game. They really slow it down. And then I went back and played like Street Fighter III. And like, it's so much harder. It's so much more complicated. But like, it doesn't feel that different. It doesn't feel at least conceptually, like philosophically, like that's one of those genres. And we don't have to stay on this particular genre topic for that much longer. But like, yeah, it's one of the things where like you said with Tekken, it got to 3, and then after 3, they really kind of hit a stride. It's same with Street Fighter 1. Street Fighter 1 was not very good. Street Fighter 2 is a huge hit. It's still one of the most popular fighting games ever made. And they just kept building off of that. But like, it's not like, if you've only played Street Fighter 2, if you've only played Street Fighter 6 and decided to go back and play Street Fighter 2, you'd be able to do it just fine. It wouldn't feel crazy to play. Amanda, what do you think?
Well, you know, something that was interesting with earlier, Sam, you had mentioned, I'm thinking about other genres, you were talking about the 2D Mario games. And as you were saying it, you were like, oh, you know, Super Mario Wonder, for example, does all these things that the old Super Mario games, you know, couldn't do, the more icons, all that stuff, which is interesting. As somebody who doesn't really play those games, I look at them and I go, yeah, this is like an updated version, but they're kind of the same thing. Like, and so I think maybe some of it too has to do with like our love for genre or our appreciation of how these games and trends evolve, right? Like, first person shooters have evolved in many niche, particular ways over the last, you know, 20 years, but like you look at games like, I don't know, like a lot of the Call of Duty games, kind of the same, right? Where you're like, I get it, you know, but then you look at GoldenEye and you're like, this is obviously different, you know, but like there is this point where there's some kind of leap that happened. Like David brought up Ocarina of Time. Like that's the game that I grew up knowing to be sort of like, this is this pinnacle of great Zelda content. It wasn't the first one, but similar to like the Tekken 3, the evolution, like I imagine with Mario, there was one too, where it's like, this is ultimately still something similar is going on here. This is a 2D platformer where Mario is jumping over pipes and bricks and he's getting there. But there is a point where the standard has shifted into a modern era that maybe has to do with sort of replayability. Like, what are the games that you just can't go back and replay? Gary was talking about doing a list of like roguelikes, and he went and played the original Rogue. And he was like, I played this as research for this piece. No one should play this game. This is unplayable. This is not fun. Like, you know, and he's like, I recognize that it's history. So maybe that is a way to define too. What is the point of unreplayability, where it's just unbearable?
Totally. I think when you mentioned Nintendo, I think Nintendo has an interesting place in all of this, because when I think Nintendo's very good at kind of future-proofing their games, because mechanically they're pristine. Like, you can go back and play any of the old Mario games, Mario 3, Mario World, and they don't play that. Maybe, I mean, Sam, you're the connoisseur here, but like, obviously they make slight innovations here or there. Like Super Mario Wonder controls a little differently. Like there's a little different look and feel, obviously, but the mechanics are the same. Like it works. Like they haven't really gone that crazy in terms of reinventing what a 2D Mario game looks and plays like. And so by effect, it's not, they haven't really ushered out anything that worked in the 90s or the 80s. So I almost have a weird feeling, like a weird kind of relationship with Nintendo, where I'm like, it doesn't feel like these games, they are retro and yet they aren't, because yeah. they still play well. Like they're, it's very different from, again, like a Final Fantasy VII, where Square Enix has done everything in its power to get away from turn-based combat and, yeah. and, you know, make everything accessible with action mechanics. And like, it's very clear that the company and the developers want to move away from what were kind of limitations of the time. Whereas Nintendo was ahead of what people wanted and has always been there. And they know their ideas are good and they just stick by it every decade. It's well, like, and, here's more of what you love.
And what I love about, I mean, Ocarina of Time is my favorite game ever made, so I love everyone bringing it up. So I, yeah, and Vaughn, you and I were aligned here. But like, I think that what's the reason why that's such a great example is, and we were talking before about graphical leaps. Once the graphical leaps stopped being as big, retro felt just the change the standard of what retro means. Ocarina of Time basically proved that you could have a reliable 3D open-ish action like adventure game. And one of the reasons why it was pioneered is that it pioneered a mechanic, which then went away for a while and then came back and is now the standard, which is lock on fighting.
Mm.
So like, because there was only one stick on the Nintendo 64 controller, you couldn't control the camera and the character at the same time, the way you can do in normal games now. So they said, well, you press the Z button, you lock on to, you know, whatever enemy you want to fight. And that way the camera just moves along where the enemy moves. And then they went away from that for a little while. And then a little game comes out in 2009 for the PlayStation 3 called Demon's Souls, the precursor to Dark Souls. Now that's back. And now that's not in every big action game, but for a lot of them. But like for, I guess not Ghost of Tsushima, notably. But when you, but when you play, you know, any kind of Souls-like, Lies of P, even games like Horizon Forbidden West, like when you lock on and like human to human combat, like that's just how the game works now. So like, that's why to me, Ocarina of Time, like visually in a lot of ways looks, you know, it looks of its time. I mean, I think still it looks beautiful and perfect, but it's like, it's these little mechanical advancements that I think yeah. are, we kind of take for granted sometimes because like, for example, I don't know if any of you have gone back, not the remasters, but played the original, like, PS2 Grand Theft Auto games, played, like, Vice City or San Andreas. There's no lock-on in that either, like, for GTA 4 and 5 or for Red Dead. And those games are weird, man. They're not that, like, they don't mechanically hold up, but when they came out, there was nothing like it with yeah. these big open worlds, which aren't even that big. Like, Vice City, you can drive around that entire world in, like, 5 minutes. Like, it just felt big because there was nothing quite like it before. But that's even like with a mechanical advancement, there's still these other things that hold it to the past. And I think now that games have kind of normalized and streamlined a lot of these mechanics starting from like the 360 PS3 generation, they don't seem that old. Like Grand Theft Auto 4 doesn't seem that old compared to GTA 3. Halo 4 and Halo 5 and Infinite's pretty recent, but like they do feel faster and more crisp than the earlier Halo games, even if I still think the Bungie Halo games are better. So it's just sometimes these little things that hold, that lock something to a time.
Just the implementation of sprint in that case, Sam, right? Like
yeah.
a world of difference. And I'm sure, and it always, I feel like with a lot of these trends or innovations, there tends to be kind of like almost like a fan in the moment, like a fan backlash. Like I remember when Halo 4 implemented sprint, people were like, what are you doing? Like, What are we doing here? I can't remember if it started in 4 or Reach, but
it was 4 because that was when it was trying to be more like Call of Duty.
Yeah, and I remember folks were like, and now when I think of Halo, I'm like, okay, yeah, there's sprint in it. Same thing with like, I think there you still see the people on in the Zelda camp where Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom went away from deviated from the traditional structure, and I know we're still going through the growing pains of that, but I'm pretty sure that we'll look back on this era of Zelda and be like, yeah, like that folks are going to look back fondly on this era, just as they look back fondly on the old era. And at some point, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom will feel retro. It's just a question of when, you know, Nintendo decides to innovate again with the series.
Yeah, I do have I want to. I mean, that's a good point, and I have very mixed feelings on that Zelda situation. I love all the new Zelda games. There's just a part of me like, what if we got like Wind Waker 2? I don't know. But like, I personally think it's important for us to at least have this kind of institutional knowledge, right? Like, even if you love Tears of the Kingdom, you still should know about Ocarina of Time, Link to the Past, things like that. Would you say there's a particular value in playing retro games? Like, not just playing old games, but playing them as close to the original platform concept as they were. Like, not as a remaster, not on Switch, but like, if you want to play Pokemon Silver, if you play it on a Game Boy, that's a fundamentally different experience than playing the virtual console version on 3DS. You know what I mean? Like, am I alone here in believing some of that to some extent?
No, I think one of the things too that we're also talking around is the relationship between retro and nostalgia and love, and also then love, right? Like, I think some of what we might have attachment to is like, oh, for me, I remember playing Pokemon Silver on my Game Boy, I guess it was a Color. And I remember running out of AA batteries, like on a long car ride, and begging my parents to like pull over to a gas station, get me more batteries, and like plugging the light in and my friend link cable, you know, so I can trade Pokemon. Right. And so I think there's some of it that to hold that technology feels really special. And to like, if you hold an old Game Boy, you're like, God, this thing was like the original Game Boy. You're like, this thing is huge. I do think there's some games that, you know, it was interesting. You were bringing up the old controller with like one joystick. I think like so many of the controllers now for so many of like the consoles they're trending similar. Like they all kind of function.
They're all exactly the same, basically.
Yeah, they're all exactly the same, you know, like, and they're all like, you can, even if you don't have one, like the Switch, you're like, you can buy a thing to fit your Joy-Cons in there so it looks exactly like, or like the controller they all have. I think there are some, I'll say it for David, and I'm sure he'll say it too. I think the Nintendo DS continues to be like a really special game structure, particular, or like a gaming device, particularly for a game like Hotel Dusk, which you flip the DS on its side and it reads like a book. You could play that on the Switch. I just think it's less magical that way. I mean, not that they've ported it, but I think there are some things where to see some of this technology, I don't know. I think it's cool. What do you think, David?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, Amanda. You said the point better than I could have. I think the context matters so much. Like, Sam, you said the example with the Z targeting for Ocarina of Time. If I'm emulating Ocarina of Time on a Steam Deck, and you don't have the knowledge of the hardware that it came on out of the box originally, you'd be like, well, why can't I use the second stick to control the camera? How do I do this? And it's like, no, that's not how this game worked, right? Like, it had a unique look and feel, just like when you're playing Super Mario Galaxy, it had a unique look and feel when you're, you know, pointing at the star bits. Sometimes those innovations can result, like, sometimes you can bring a console, a game to a new console and have a new lease on life. Like, that was my personal opinion with Resident Evil 4 when they brought it to Wii. Like, I loved being able to aim to shoot, and I know that might be a hot take, but
I'm the hot take where it feels wrong without a GameCube controller.
No, it's fair. Like, and that's the beauty of having options. I'm never going to be one to say, you know, oh, don't emulate games on your Steam Deck. But I think if you're going to really want to immerse yourself in, you know, what the game came from and understand and appreciate the game in the way it was originally intended by the developers, I think it's important at least to understand, you know, why Ocarina of Time doesn't have a second, an actual camera stick.
Yeah. Talking this through, sorry, Vaughn, did you have something to say about that or?
No, okay. Go ahead. I'll jump back.
This actually, while we're talking this through, it actually helps me better define retro. I think once platform-specific feel went away, that's when things kind of stopped feeling retro. So, for example, we're all big Xbox 360 fans here, if I play an Xbox 360 game on my Xbox Series X, it doesn't feel wrong. It feels the same because it basically is the same. If I play Halo 3 or Dishonored or Mass Effect or Red Dead Redemption 1, like, I'm not like, oh, this is just kind of a bastardized experience. Like, no, it's basically the same thing. It's just, you know, I can also play Call of Duty Black Ops 6. Like, I can also play Avowed on this. Whereas whenever I play like an N64 game on Switch, on their Switch online service, I'm like, yeah, this is still a little weird. It's a little different. Like, this feels old. This feels retro. Because when you just copy and paste it onto a modern platform, I played GoldenEye on Switch Online. There's a lot of reasons that game doesn't hold up mechanically, but it especially doesn't hold up when I'm used to using my right index finger to shoot, and I have to use my left finger the way it is on Switch. You know, whereas it's not that way with newer games. But well, Amanda, what do you want to say about that?
Totally. I mean, like, I think you're totally right on that. Like, what does it feel like to play it? Like, I'm thinking of fighting games with Vaughn. Like, I'm thinking about the arcade that you maybe have two toggles. You maybe just have one. And, you know, you maybe have two buttons. Like, some of those old games, like, I used to have this. Somebody gave it to me for my birthday when I was, like, 8 years old, which was that it was, like, a single joystick, one button arcade game set that had like car racing.
Oh yeah, the one you plug into the TV.
Yes, yeah. You plug into the TV. Yes. Yeah, like, yes. Exactly. And that was like sort of like, I don't know, I was probably more like 12, and it was sort of mind blowing for me because I was like, this is just one stick and like one button, like, and yet I can do so much, and I'm like, and it's asking me to think and play differently in a way that like. Even like the Street Fighter games, for example, as they advance, there's more and more buttons that are that you can click, which the experience of having one button is very different.
Yeah, I think we saw that shift with fighting games. I think like you look at the modern Tekkens, like they don't use the bumpers on the top of the, like the controllers anymore. Like, they're kind of like, oh, like this is an option, you can use them, but like now we've assigned like features for what these buttons can do. Whereas before, for years, it was like, oh, you can map these to what you want them to be. Do what you want. And then you hit like Tekken 7. They're like, yeah, we've decided we're going to use these in the game now. So like no more of this mapping to create combos that you think work well. But I think, yeah, it's interesting you talk about hardware when it comes to some of these things. And, you know, Nintendo famously used to love to like come up with these like hardware ideas that like didn't really pan out, right? Like you had like the arm. That came out for the
Power Glove.
The Power Glove.
Now you're
glove.
Playing with
yeah.
power.
Yeah. And you know, everyone used to have the little, you know, little guns we played with at home. That's part of the retro experience, right? You plug in the gun, change the game. Now you're playing Time Crisis at home with a little gun controller. And we've slowly moved away from those things, right? And I think that's part of the retro experience. You brought up Metal Gear Solid 1. You know, there's that famous, you know, boss fight where they I'm not gonna say which one, in case you know.
I was about to say it. But...
Hey, yeah. Spoilers for Metal Gear Solid 1, a game that came out X amount of years ago. But yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, you have to switch memory cards, and then you're doing that. Like when I played it, I was playing on PlayStation 3. When you switch memory cards on a PS3, you just go into the menu, click a button. But like on PS1, that's a physical experience. You gotta grab that bad boy, shove it over into slot 2, and you're like, we're in business now. It's just physically the experience has changed with retro as well.
But that's also like what David was saying before about how Nintendo future proofs games. Like, you're for the most part pressing the same buttons in Super Mario Kart for the Super Nintendo as you are in Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. Like, the visuals are quite different. The complexity of the courses is totally different. The verticality is different. But like, the tactile experience is still mostly the same. So that's why, to me, like, Super Mario Kart doesn't feel as or Mario Kart 64 don't feel totally. Quite as dated as other racing games from those generations. Like, I played Ridge Racer 64 on Switch Online like a couple months ago, and like, you know what? It definitely was a game of its time. It's like, it tries to bring in like drifting into it, which I'm sure was amazing in the year 2000. But like, it's just really wonky and it doesn't work that well. And if you mess up, you basically lose the race. But like, that's an important thing is Nintendo games are retro, but they don't feel quite as retro as other games of that era, you know?
And maybe part of it is like what feels like a little bit like we're all these old people telling the young kids what games used to be like, because I recently was trying to explain Guitar Hero and Rock Band to my like 14-year-old like kind of cousin nephew, and he was just like, I don't understand, like, is it a real guitar? And I'm like, no, it's a controller, and it defined parties for years, and like this was everything. And then there was also drums, and he was like, you bought a set of drums? And I'm like, no, they were like fake electronic drums that were also buttons, and this was like this, if you had this set, you were the cool house to be at. And he's just like, well, you could just play real drums. I'm like, I know, like, I can't explain to you enough that this was just like a moment. And so like to think that I don't know, how old was the original Guitar Hero? I remember playing that in 2007 at a party, you know, like that.
Yeah, well, that was probably like the mid to late 2000s. Right? But that's the thing. Like I said, like,
it's going to be 20 years ago.
That's like about, but again, it's about the same age as Gears of War, and Gears of War doesn't feel dated, but Guitar Hero does, you know?
Yes, totally, totally.
Yeah, I will say that I think there's a little bit of nuance between something like Rock Band and Guitar Hero, because we still at the very least, you can go into an arcade, like a barcade, and there'll be a rock, or a cruise ship, and there will undoubtedly be a Rock Band, a Guitar Hero station where you can at least pick up a guitar. Like, I feel like that's still there's a place to appreciate that, and we see it a little bit of a resurgence with like the Fortnite festival, but it's not the same thing. Like, you know, no one's breaking out the old Rock Band set to play that. Whereas, like, I think it kind of comes back to what game makers are willing to stand by their ideas. Like, I can use Halo again as an example. When you keep remapping the buttons and trying to innovate, like, I love innovation, but sometimes it feels like innovation for the sake of innovation, when companies can just stick by the ideas that, I mean, Nintendo is the ultimate, will continue to always be the example of, we believe in our ideas, and we know it was fun 20 years ago, it's going to be fun 20 years in the future. And I know that they're, you know, in the case of something like Rock Band, I don't know how it really worked, you know, economically with selling those things. I still am holding out hope that we could see a resurgence of that, but it's no wonder that your relative doesn't get it, because no game maker has tried to make people get it in the decade gap. You know, it's like no one has come for that that market in the years since Rock Band, you know, kind of fell out of relevance.
Well, this is what Vaughn was talking about earlier. Like, you said once Wi-Fi took over, like, Rock Band was kind of like the final front for playing at like with your friends in person. And now everyone does these days. And we always say like, oh, this is what the kids are doing. They're all playing Fortnite or Minecraft on or Roblox or whatever. And like, that's what adults are doing too, man. Like, everyone's just like, hey, there's a new Call of Duty. We just play that now. Let's do Warzone. Let's play PUBG. People are still playing Counter-Strike. Like, this game is like 25 years old. And like, once that experience became less normalized, of just like multiplayer is, there's four people crowding on a small couch in front of a 12-inch CRT TV to play Perfect Dark. Like, once that's kind of whittled away, that felt like an entirely different way to understand gaming as a medium.
100%. And I think I wanted to reference arcades again, because David had brought it up too. I think that the idea of having games at home and only at home versus games mostly externally, like the arcade being this place in the 80s that is this, you go to there to play games, like that becomes the social space. The games are meant to be, you don't take that giant console home, like that's crazy, like pinball bars, all these things, right? And now even to take, I took someone to a Dave and Buster's who had never been, and they were like, oh, it's like so old school in here. And I'm like, and they've never been to any arcade, but it's just the idea of going to a separate location where these games will be, it becomes this sort of archive, even if all the games are not old school at Dave and Buster's. They got all this new stuff. They got Fruit Ninja, that's also Kung Fu Panda, like all these things. But I think there's something to be said there about that separation of the, like, the shared game experience. What is this thing that becomes another space versus the at-home space that we share together? What do you think, Vaughn?
Yeah, I think it's honestly cultural, right? I mean, I think over time we've seen shifts. We moved to Wi-Fi, you know, I think like in other countries, they have internet cafes, they just have places, they have hubs where people gather, right? Like you look at the Nintendo DS era that we talked about, and you know, Japanese developers are building games that require like party interaction, right? You saw that with Pokemon, right? But you look at the PSP, you look at the DS, it's like, oh, we're having these local events for these games online. Oh,
like LAN parties. That was a LAN parties.
Yeah, the LAN parties.
Going to
right.
show up and playing Age of Empires 2 all sitting together, like with their computers all plugged in together.
Right. And we could do that here, but like, I think, you know, and I'm going to harp on Sony because, you know, that, those are my boys sometimes. you know, the PSP had a lot of LAN party style games, and you didn't get that same experience, which is why part of the reason why that console suffered here is. Okay, you have Phantasy Star Online. It has a bunch of LAN things. Like, I'm not going to be playing with my friends at an internet cafe, right? Like, that's not happening. Even as late as, like, you saw this with the Vita, as late as, like, Final Fantasy, almost called it by its old name. What is it? Versus? Not Versus.
15?
Type-0. Oh, Type-0. Yeah, it still had those same elements, right? Where, like, you can gain items if you are playing with a party under certain conditions online. And you're like, this game is clearly designed for PSP, but released for PS Vita in the US. Like, so the hardware changes, as much as like the cultural differences in development and when they were developing some of these features, is something you see. And yeah, we still have David Busters. And honestly, that's the closest thing we have to that like hub where we're all in the same space in the US playing games together. Like, we don't see that anywhere else.
Fun fact, the first time I ever hung out with Amanda was at Dave and Buster's.
Yes, it was. Yeah. I was planning a party for my then boyfriend, who was a friend of Sam's.
Who was her now husband. It's not
was
like
my now husband. Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, let's go to the Dave and Buster's at like midnight.
In Times Square.
In Times Square. Well, it was really fun until all the kids showed up.
Oh, what were the kids doing there?
That's exactly. I was like, it's your bedtime. This is our time.
And crazy. David, what do you got to say?
Yeah, I was just going to add one. I think, I forget whose point it was, but when we talk about the way that game makers can kind of steer the culture, right? Vaughn, you talked about the culture, and I think your points about I never even really thought about the application of Sony handhelds in you know, Japan versus the West, a really interesting point. But I think a recent example that I've seen from a retro game, kind of like, I think for gamers that have an appreciation of retro games, part of the way forward, for lack of a better term, is like appreciating the new innovations and creating games that can mimic the feel of retro without it actually being retro. So I'm writing out my review of Split Fiction. And so that's a good example of like Hazelight Studio, I think is, it has the pulse of something really interesting, which is like, there's no other console game makers out there currently that are trying to really tap into the feeling of playing local co-op, maybe outside of like the Overcooked devs. But they're taking it a step further by literally like making it a split screen experience that is mandatory. So if you play it online, even if you're playing online, it's split screen because that's foundational to the game. So that allows the developers to make the game feel fresh and modern and do interesting things. And I won't give anything away, but Split Fiction does some interesting things with that side-by-side viewpoint. And that's something you wouldn't get on an old console, yet it definitely evokes feelings of playing split screen with a friend when you're going through like Halo 1 co-op. It's a weird feeling to kind of live in that space where it feels like, and there are tons of homage to older games, tons of unique ideas that I'm sure future games will mimic. So I'd love to see more game makers do that, where they just can like, they can lean into the retro aesthetic or some mechanics. Like if someone has a cool idea on how to leverage the motion controls on the Switch 2 while not making it feel like a rehash, like I would love to see that. I think there's a lot there that it just takes taking some risks and having publishers that are ready to sign off on them.
And that risks thing, I mean, obviously the video game industry has had a tumultuous last couple of years, a lot of layoffs, revenues are going down, games are taking longer than ever to make. Like almost every major idea like that is a risk. And as a result, we've seen companies decide, hey, our games are going to go multi-platform now when they might have been exclusive. Everything is cross-play. It's not like everyone has to have an Xbox if they want to play the same game together. Like, you can play Fortnite on anything. You can play a Call of Duty Warzone on anything except for the Switch. Like, you can play things on cloud, you can play things on your phone. Like, and like once you flatten that, like, that's probably like a net good, I would say, the crossplay part of things. But at the same time, now there's no way to really try something goofy. Like,
yeah,
you mentioned PSP, like, if you can play local multiplayer games. One of my favorite things about the DS was that there were a lot of games multiplayer where only one person actually had to have the game. So like, if me and three friends all had a DS, if one person had Mario Kart DS, the other two of us could still play locally multiplayer together, like, if, as long as we're all close by. And like, something like that's just not really going to happen anymore.
No.
I mean, shout out to Hazelight, though. They have the Friend Pass thing, right? Which is like such a weird thing considering EA publishes the game. And that's been an institution. Like, they are known for doing that. They're like one of the only studios that is like, yeah, you only need one copy of the game to play.
Yeah, and that's really great. But just, I do want to think one more thing about Fortnite specifically. Well, I'm not a fan of Fortnite, but not because of what I'm about to say. But Fortnite first came out in 2017, and people are still playing it now, and it's constantly evolving and changing. And so, like, in like 10 years from now, is Fortnite still going to be around? And B, like, would Fortnite 2017, by that standard, be retro the way that a game from like 18 years ago now might feel? Because like, now that these games don't end, there isn't like a logical endpoint for some of these games now. They just kind of keep going. Rainbow Six Siege is just still going. Counter-Strike is still going. Even with Counter-Strike 2, that's just more of the same. You know, it's like...
The games as a service is changing it.
Yeah, as our understanding of what a game is changing so much that, like, in the future, the way we think about games now as retro, would that be different because these games never really stop? Like, No Man's Sky is a different game, totally different game now than it was when it came out, as another example. Vaughn, what do you guys say about that?
Yeah, I'll say with Fortnite, even the 2017 version is different. I mean, I've been seeing the memes of like, old man, this is not 2017 Fortnite, don't come play this. And then they come and play and they get wiped, like, immediately. It's just, gameplay's different, you know? Like, you got kids running around as Beerus from Dragon Ball Z at the same time you got kids running around as Naruto, right? Like, this is just a very different Fortnite than like you're used to. The combat's changed, the speed of combat's different, the maps are different. So I mean, Fortnite 10 years from now, I don't know. I mean, the billions keep rolling in, so as long as the money's right, like, I'm assuming it'll be like a Minecraft at that point, just with the sheer amount of content. I mean, I think you have some games that have done this, like, survived the transition into the future really well. You look at Warframe, that's the game I picked up, I played that a little bit last year, and I was like, wow, I'm sure being a 10-0 like 10 years ago was different than being a 10-0 today, right? And that's just what they call the Warframes, your character. But yeah, just like the way worlds can grow with the service platform. And a lot of that really comes down to who the developer is, right? What decisions are they making, right? Looking back to Fortnite, you look at Rocket League, and like, that is a community that is slowly dying. I love Rocket League. I put it in my like top 20 games ever made. Like, that game's gotten hundreds of hours of my life. But like, the development for it is slowly being absorbed into Fortnite. And, you know, eventually maybe we'll just have Rocket League as a memory of what Fortnite was. I think last thing I'll say about, you know, games as a service is, like, you know, you have games like Apex Legends and Marvel Rivals, which just came out, but is like, both games are going to be struggling to find communities. Apex, they can't decide between hardcore and new core players. And with Marvel Rivals, you know, with development being all resorted back to China and closing that studio that kind of, you know, got that game out to launch, created the story, the longevity of games as a service become difficult, like, over time, because it's hard to keep an audience.
And I think I agree totally. I mean, Destiny 2 is a game that I reference sometimes that I still play with my close friend Allison, not a different Allison on the site. But we just pop in to play like one particular mode, because anytime that we try to play the rest of the game, too much has changed. It's impossible to keep up, and it's not fun. It's not fun to try to relearn this game I first played 10 years ago. And what I was going to say is, I think that this is going to be its own genre era of games as a service, where, I mean, even amongst our community, we were all talking about Sam recently led a piece about Avowed, and in our community Discord chat, people were so excited. They're like, this game will end, and we're really excited about it. Like, this is a great game. Like, David, you can finish it. Like, and I think that we, as a gaming culture, will burn out pretty hard on this, like, games as a service, and this will feel like our retro moment of these Overwatch, the Destiny, the Apex, the Fortnite, these games that just won't end. I think this, its time will come, and for some of us, it's already, we're already over it.
Yeah. Just to tie it into the retro discussion, too, I think back when I said, you know, one definition of retro is older or dated. You know, I'm not saying outdated, Sam, but like, you know, dated, like older. I think the live service component is where we risk with live service games, not older or dated, but literally obsolete. Like Overwatch was a game of the year winner, you know, up for the site. We ranked all the game of the year winners from the past decade, won at the game awards. Overwatch was on that list. I can't remember where exactly it placed, but
I think dead last.
Yeah. And regardless of why it was on, like, you can't access that game. That game, you can't play Overwatch 1. Like, Overwatch 1, the game that won game of the year, is not accessible. Like, Hearthstone is a game that I hold very near and dear. And I recently went with a buddy of mine that we played in college. We hopped back on a couple weeks ago. The game is completely different because there's just so much power creep in all the cards, and the, like, it's just the microtransactions have been ramped up, and there's just so much incentive. Like, it went from a slow paced game that was really fun to chill to now it's like you're doing your combos in like a single play as the rope burns out. It's like the game is just so different, and it's a shame because I think retro is such a beautiful way to honor and preserve and enjoy games in the state that they came out, the context. And now context is completely out the window. Sometimes it's better. Sometimes you get like a, I wouldn't call Stardew live service, but continual updates in today's environment makes for a better game. A game could be an 8, you know, a couple of years ago, and then a 10 a couple of years later. But so often it feels like we lose. I would love games to have a way for us to roll back and appreciate at least, hey, like sometimes, you know, Hearthstone Classic, World of Warcraft Classic, those were things, but then they're not preserved. Like, Blizzard doesn't preserve those things. They go away after a while, but it's just sad.
No, I mean, it is sad. And I think I recently read this piece, it was on PC Gamer, about Bungie is getting sued for a plot in Destiny 2. And they have the original first season plot has been quote unquote archived. And they say it's in the archive, it's in the vault, but you can't actually really access it. And they literally just don't have a way for you to see that old stuff anymore. And so the lawyers are using fan-made YouTube videos in the court case to explain it. And I think this gets ultimately these questions about preservation that I know Sam thinks about a lot.
Yeah, and that's, I wanted to just like roll it back into that because I have such a complicated relationship to a lot of like remakes and remasters. And I know we had a separate podcast on that a couple of years ago, but like, It's weird to me that I can play Super Mario RPG Remake on Switch, but not the original. And the remake is great. I kind of enjoyed playing it better than the original, but like, that's not the point. Like, there might be people out there who say, I would rather play Hearthstone the way it is now than the way it was in 2014. They might feel that way about Destiny. They might feel that way about Fortnite. They might feel that way about No Man's Sky. Some people loved it at launch, and that's the game that they have in their mind forever. But like, what, not just in terms of like the live service games, but these other games, like I literally like fist pump and get excited when someone announces some collection of games that they're selling for $20, even if they're games I don't give a shit about. Like, the Mega Man Battle Network games, I haven't played any of those, but when a couple years ago Capcom's like, hey, you can play all of these now, I'm like, yes, someone's going to be really excited about that. But maybe not me, but like, I'm just glad that it's happening, because otherwise we just kind of lose this stuff. And that then retro gaming then becomes, you have to play it on the original console. Like the DS, like there's some rumors that the Switch 2 might have some DS type functionality if you like turn the screen on its side and get some special thing. I would love that. But like right now, if I want to play Meteos or Elite Beat Agents or like Hotel Dusk, as you guys point out, there's no other way for me to do it unless I have the cart.
And you're lucky if you can even find a cartridge for a lot of these games.
If you want to play Pokemon Soul Silver, you better be willing to pay $200 to some rando on eBay. You know what I mean?
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Like, that's insane to me. Like, that's,
yeah.
And so, like, I guess, like, I know I have my strong feelings about that, but like, what do you guys think of, like, for the, not just the big players, but for games that are kind of in limbo, these games that have some, that maybe were developed by companies that went under, like, what responsibility do these game makers have to making sure that these old games still have a place in our lives?
I would like to see developers, particularly like these huge companies that have the opportunity, like for a studio that went under 30 years ago, that's tough. I get it. But for these big studios, these big companies, these big publishers, I'd like to see them invest more in their archive and making that stuff available. I think taking pride in that. I'd also like to see, there's been a couple different versions of video game museums or explorations or books. I'd love to see a version of the Library of Congress, even if the Library of Congress, like, it'd be great right now. It's not a great time for federal funding, but for, especially for education and the arts, but it would be great to see a version of that where there is recognizing this media and making it publicly accessible in some way, in some version. There's, I want to give a quick shout out. I did my master's degree in fine arts at the University of Pittsburgh. And there's this professor, Zachary Horton, who runs a program called the Vibrant Media Lab. And he is like one of the, this in this lab is one of the preeminent authorities of the Odyssey, which is like the first video game console. And it, they are like collecting them. It is, this shit is ancient. Like, he brought them to class and they had to be, they were like seven and we all had to be really careful with it. And we were all like, and there's so few left in the world, you know, but this is an academic effort to preserve this stuff, to rebuild it and share why it mattered. And so if it's not going to be the private companies, I'd ideally like to see a public investment in it. And if it's not that, then it's going to be, you know, cool academics, cool nerds, you know, like if I ever get crazy rich, I'll open up a cool video game museum in my house, you know, or maybe not my house. I don't want people that close to me, but like maybe a building nearby where people could come. Like, those are just my gut thoughts. And shout out to Zach for that, because that's real. But go ahead, David.
Yeah, no, I echo your sentiments. I think sadly, in the private sector, for, you know, publishers who, let's be honest, the suits at the top of your, you know,
yeah, TJs, why would they? And actors, yeah.
Like, they don't even play the game, so why do they care about preserving it? But I would say I do think there's a public like necessity to preserve these games and to at least partner with private companies to make it happen. But I also would argue for the big publishers of the world that it helps, you know, Amanda, you and I, we're in marketing, like, it helps your brand. It helps your brand to assure gamers that you care about your history, because then gamers give a shit about your future, right? It's like, you, whether or not you want to deviate or innovate, right? I don't think anyone looks at Nintendo and is like, yeah, Nintendo like doesn't care about its past or how it got here. Like, maybe some people, maybe Kay would be like, yeah, no, they look at how look at how they treat Melee tournaments and the community. But I think with some few exceptions, like, I look at Nintendo and the state of Zelda and it's like, I think they're just trying to provide the best possible experience at any one time for their fan base, and innovation is just the natural route to get there. But at the same time, you know, it's frustrating, to your point, Sam, to look at Nintendo and be like, why can't I access, like, why can't I just purchase a one-time license to have my Mario games and not have to deal with this shit ever, you know, ever again? And I'll give Microsoft the rare props that they have made it exceedingly easy to bring my library from what, like, regardless, you could publish every Microsoft game for the rest of time on every other platform, and I'll still consider an Xbox, just because of the quality of being able to preserve my games, bring it from one console to the next, like, just have no, like, feel like I have access to it, especially physical media in an age where digital games, who knows how long before they get delisted or if a service goes down like PlayStation Network. And then I don't have access to my games all of a sudden. That's really important. So I think some companies are doing it better than others, but it definitely behooves companies to put the fans first, and you know, just a small investment in preservation, if it's possible, I think goes a long way.
All right, Vaughn, you got some thoughts, and then we're gonna wrap up and get to the next segment.
Yeah, I would say to both David and Amanda's points, yeah, I think preservation is, like, you know, significant. It needs to be done. It's like honestly key to like this industry moving forward. It's honestly embarrassing that like big game companies lose source code. I've seen this stat that like 90% of source code before 2010 is lost, and like
insane.
I mean, if you're Square Enix and like you don't have the source code for Final Fantasy VIII and you're having to like rebuild it from like someone's like copy, it's like that's embarrassing, because like these games have won multiple awards. Some of these series have won multiple awards. Like, you don't just have a copy inside a case. Like, this is the source code. Put it inside the platinum selling case on the wall. Break it if we need it, right? Like this feels like something elementary. Like, even your basic developer who's like starting out is told, hey, make sure you preserve your code. Like, so the fact that big companies not doing this is honestly embarrassing. And I think it speaks like the mismanagement we see in the industry ballooning with budgets, right? Like, if you can't handle source code, how are you supposed to manage these like large source budgets? But I digress. Getting back to retro, I think emulation is honestly the best museum that we have. And I'll shout out like Brave New World, which is like a Final Fantasy VI emulation. It's technically Final Fantasy III, but I'm not going to get it. We all know the history of, you know, they didn't put Final Fantasy VI out here right away. It came out as Final Fantasy III, like, and that whole, you know, discombobulated release process. But yeah, just the way I can play this game on my Mac, it's been emulated, it's been preserved in its original form. Now someone's edited it to make it a better version, but I think emulation is honestly the best way you can play a lot of these games in their original form. And legality, you know.
Emulation is legal. It's piracy.
Emulation is legal.
Piracy, that's, yeah. But emulation is legal. I want to say that. life is short. Don't spend it in jail.
Facts. But don't let Nintendo catch you.
Yeah, no, don't just shh. That's my advice. Shh. Don't make it hot. on that note, we got a fun little game called Who You Got coming up in a bit, but we're going to pause for a short little break. See you back in a minute. All right, welcome back to the Punished Podcast. We're going to have a little fun, I don't want to call it much of a game, but a little exercise for all the guests here on the podcast. We like to do something in our group Discord. I like to call it Who You Got. It's kind of a bracket challenge. This is less of a bracket. We're just going to throw a couple of matchups in there and just see how we feel. This is retro related, so I want to repeat. Whoever wins each matchup, that's the winner. It's not bracket style.
Okay.
I'm going to start with the first real console war that mattered, and it's because it's the first console war that I remembered. Who You Got? Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis.
Oof.
We're just doing this in terms of quality of the games?
Whatever you want. And also, like, why are you taking so long? It's a Super Nintendo. What's the matter?
It's Super Nintendo.
It was a Super Nintendo, yeah.
Rules, but yeah, Super Nintendo.
I've at least played a Super Nintendo once or twice before.
I was trying to get Genesis a chance, like, you know, let me think.
Rip.
I mean, listen, man, I played a lot of Sega Genesis at the dentist office, all right? I have an appreciation for that.
It's a great dentist office. Yeah.
He was literally named Dr. Best. He was pretty good.
Yeah, he was.
he was fine.
Is he still practicing? Get me in there.
I want to say it was the first console war, because like some dorks are going to come out and be like, well, it was actually the ColecoVision versus the Intellivision back in 1988. but no, like this was like the source of all, like, where it all started. It's Genesis does what Nintendo don't. That was their tagline. It was, check out how fast these graphics go. Mario can't go as fast as Sonic. The Super Nintendo doesn't have anything like Vector Man. You know, that game we all know and love, Vector Man.
Ooh, classic.
Yeah, that's definitely a game Amanda knows about.
Yeah, I definitely heard those words before.
This is the Panzer Dragoon Saga argument, I think, right? Where that comes from?
That's Saturn. Sega Saturn.
That's Saturn.
Is different.
Okay.
Yeah, that's actually one of the few game consoles that has come out in my lifetime that I've not ever played. I've never held a Sega Saturn controller. I couldn't even tell you what it looks like. Have you played a Sega Saturn?
I think I have, yeah. I think my cousin had one, because he had, what was that game? Oh, I don't even remember what the game is now. oh, the one about dreams. They just re-released it.
Nights into Dreams.
Yes. I mean, but that was Dreamcast, right?
Well, no, that was Sega Saturn. That was the Sonic creator.
It is.
All right, we don't have to keep talking about the Sega Saturn.
That's nice. I'm sure somebody's happy that people are still talking about the Sega Saturn. I'm sure you've just made somebody's day.
Yeah, someone's like fist pumping. Sega Saturn mentioned.
they could just feel it in the ether.
Let's do a totally different console war that was just a few years later. Who you got, the Nintendo 64 or the very first PlayStation?
Oof,
this one's going to be a little tougher for a lot of people. Not for me. I'm a Nintendo guy.
Say the 64. I mean, I didn't have a PlayStation. I remember my grandfather had one, and it was cool. But I think N64, even as a kid, it just felt like that was the thing to have. I wanted one so bad.
It's tough. I lean 64 because two of the greatest games ever are on there, and Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. I guess you could throw in Mario 64 if you want, but PS1 had some bangers too. It's a good game, good system.
I think most people wouldn't say PlayStation. I think that we're just a kind of a Nintendo lean. I don't know, Vaughn, you're getting squirmy, man. I know you're thinking of Tekken 3. Tekken 3, and that's an important PlayStation game, man.
Listen, Ocarina of Time is the greatest game ever made, but I'm going PlayStation because of Gran Turismo and like all these classics I have. We had both, so, you know, like my brother and I are 12 years apart, so it was just a generational difference, right? He had NES growing up, and then he got a 64 eventually, and then I started off as a PlayStation. That was a birthday gift. So yeah, I'm going to say PS1. I'm going to be controversial on this podcast.
It's a safe space.
Well, but also I think like N64, I think as David said, like the top level N64 games are like
they're
so good.
Peak, yeah.
Like there's even outside the Zelda games and Mario 64, like Star Fox 64, Banjo-Kazooie, like I think F-Zero X is better than any racing game on the PS1. But the PS1 has like a higher quantity of like at least good games. Like all the Spyro and Crash games, Final Fantasy, obviously all of those. Metal Gear Solid, Ridge Racer Type 4, Wipeout. Like you can keep going down. It's just like the N64 has like maximum 20 good games. But those 20 good games to me are like better than most of the top
bangers, and they're bangers that have lasted as signs of quality. Like people, like on this podcast, the amount of times that Ocarina of Time has come up. I mean, when was that? When was that game released? Like
1998.
Exactly. So like that's crazy. That game is almost 30 years old, and people are just like, "This is an amazing game." So I think it is also there's something to be said for legacy and impact on the culture.
But also Final Fantasy VII and Metal Gear Solid. I mean,
yeah. Seven came out in 98 too, right?
On the PlayStation
97, yeah.
Metal Gear Solid came out in 98.
I didn't realize Seven predated Ocarina of Time. That's interesting.
Yeah.
It was a whole debate with my brother's friends in high school. That's why I remember.
Oh, okay. Let's stick on this for Final Fantasy VII original versus Remake Rebirth.
I'm going to go OG. That's controversial.
You know, it's interesting. I think we've actually had a version of this particular vote a couple of times on the podcast. We had an episode about
visuals.
You know, the way visual arts. Yeah, we had one, and we also talked about it on remake versus remasters. I think for me, I'm gonna be Remake Rebirth. Like I admire and acknowledge the historical impact of Seven Original, but I look at that and I'm like, I'm never gonna go play that. Like that was not something I had access to as a child, and when I look at it now, I'm like, cool, like, neat. Like, to me, that is a pre-cutoff of, like, happy for you. Sorry that happened to you, but I ain't reading all that. Like,
yeah, I actually last night, I was at the Rebirth Orchestral World Tour.
Oh, cool.
We had a stop in Boston. Nice. So I was just immersed in that world and just seeing all the people in that, it was in the Bok Wang Theater, if you're familiar, Sam. But just seeing folks like dressed up as Aerith and Tifa and Cloud and Zack and all, like, it's so much bigger than the original game. Like it spans movies and novels and, you know, I'm sure other different media and anime and all kinds of stuff. It's impossible for me not to appreciate what what Square has accomplished with just two out of these three games, even if it has its issues for sure. But I don't know. It's like, I was thinking about it yesterday. It's not, reminds me of like the ending of like Game of Thrones or something, where it's like, I've never seen so many people just like patiently waiting for the end of a trilogy of a game where the story holds so much weight as this. Like, I don't think I've seen this before. You can make a case for like Halo or, you know, but it's
Mass Effect.
Maybe. I mean, I love Mass Effect, Amanda, but
I think this is a much bigger cultural moment and interesting. I think it's interesting, David, as we were talking, I was thinking if you could say the same reasons that you were describing and be making an argument for the original and being like, it had this impact legacy. But on the other hand, like, I do think that they're doing something really interesting. Like, I remember knowing the plot of Final Fantasy VII, the original, without having ever played it. And the remake Rebirth has brought me into it because it wasn't something I could access then. So yeah, I don't know. The music's amazing. And I hear you on that cultural moment. I think it's fun to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Totally. All right. I got one for Amanda. Well, it's for a little bit of all of us. 2D cozy games or 3D cozy games. So we're talking like Stardew Valley versus Animal Crossing, Fields of Mystria versus Disney Dreamlight. Like, I'm saying is, like, I know this doesn't seem quite like a retro discussion, but like, there are people out there who swear by the old Harvest Moon games over the new ones, you know?
I do. I love the old Harvest Moon games. My favorite Harvest Moon game is Friends of Mineral Town, and then also they came out with another one a couple years later where you could play a girl and date the guys instead, because it was only cishet relationships. More Friends of Mineral Town. And my husband was clicking through the PlayStation catalog yesterday, and on like on the PSN, you know, games library or whatever, and they had a Story of Seasons, which is when the company split, it went two different directions, and one of them got, you know, it's called Story of Seasons, Friends of Mineral Town. And I got really excited. I was like, oh my god, that's my shit, like, I love that, I'm so excited, you know. And then I was like, oh, it's the like 3D bullshit like remake version, I don't care about that. Like, I think
so where are you going then?
2D, I think I'm going 2D. like, I think that there's I say this with a caveat, like, my probably top favorite choice would be games that merge the two. There's a game called Mail Time, which is adorable, where the movement is 3D, but when you're talking, it's 2D character art. And that does a really good job. I think there's something, I don't know. I would still say if I have to vote, I'll say 2D, because I think there's something quintessentially comforting about just like little tiny squares that like move and they do other little tiny square things, and it like it creates a sense that there's order to the universe. I think it's part of the reason Minecraft is so popular, right? Like, there's a sense like you can put little things together and it becomes other things, and like, that's okay. So I'll say 2D.
Well, you guys got any thoughts on that?
I had to refresh my memory and Google cozy games real quick just to like get a sense of, because I feel like
there's a lot of good information out the punishedbacklog.com. Well,
yeah,
100%. We got a lot of good coverage there,
especially from Allison.
No, I was trying to find our article. That was what I was looking at. I think I lean 2D because I just feel like, to your point, Amanda, there's something like it's kind of embedded in the genre. When I think cozy, pixel art evokes kind of a feeling, like a warmth.
A certain retro warmth, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't even know if it's tied to that. Like, part of it is the retro aesthetic, but I also think that you can do some things with retro, like with the minimalist art.
Yeah.
That is like, it's almost when you get into the technical 3D stuff, unless you're Nintendo with like an Animal Crossing and you really have a strong art style, I don't know if it necessarily evokes the same feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That said, there are some 3D games that like I recently played a demo for an upcoming Annapurna game called Wanderstop that I know Allison covered too in an upcoming indie list, and it's like it's cozy personified. Like, it's just, you have that beautiful kind of it's not cel shaded, but just the style of it. I think it's just easier to make the style work in 2D, and obviously you have the benefit of Stardew, which is like the quintessential cozy game in your back pocket, so it's really hard to bet against that. So I'll go 2D for now, for today.
Vaughn, any thoughts?
I'll go 2D. I don't really play cozy games. I have nothing against the genre, though. Like, I just don't. Like, Slay the Spire is my cozy game.
There you go.
And that's 2D.
That's cozy.
All right, I got a couple more of these. I have three more, so it's cool. Let's get through this one. I think we go pretty quickly. 2D Mario versus 3D Mario.
3D.
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 I was gonna say probably 2D, but mostly just because I have fond memories of being really, really bad at a really old 2D Mario, and it just makes me remember childhood and when I felt happy.
Yeah, my favorite Mario game is 2D, but I do think 3D has higher. 3D's got higher highs. 2D is more consistently good.
Yeah,
that's fair.
All
right, this is the one I said, Vaughn. This one I want everyone's opinion, but I know I needed Vaughn's on this one particularly. For fighting games, arcade board versus home controller.
Ooh.
So you're playing Tekken, Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, Soul Calibur. You got the stick in the buttons. Or you got your regular ass controller at home. What do you got?
Dude, I'm gonna go controller, which you know, because
controversial.
Only because on a controller, it is not me being dependent on how sticky those buttons are. A game machine.
Playing this game after like eating a bunch of gummy bears,
listen, you go to the arcade stick. You know,
I gotta bring my. I have to buy one. Yeah, I'll have to buy one and, you know, make it a better informed decision. Every time I go to the arcade, I feel like I get screwed. I'm like, hey, this button's sticky. This button is, hey, yo, someone come fix this. I can't sidestep. It's like, they don't care. They're not invested like me. And so, home controller.
Yeah, I go home controller, not because it's sticky, because my mind can't comprehend having my hand like a claw on top of the buttons.
Oh, just I like it so much. I would pick those. I just love the smash. Like, I just get really excited. I'm just like,
I got to go arcade, too. I'm a casual fighting game player, so maybe that factors in. But
me, too. I would also iconic. Say I'm extremely casual. Yeah, it's just iconic. It's exciting.
Well, Vaughn's too good. His machines are always broken, so, I mean.
His move counts double because that's his genre. So.
Yeah. All right, this is the last one. And we talked a lot about split fiction, so this kind of plays into that. Couch multiplayer versus online multiplayer.
Couch, hands down.
Hands down, hands down.
It's like, if it's like just me and my friends, absolutely. Just come over, get some pizza, some sodas. Well, nowadays, maybe some beers, but probably still sodas. play some Time Splitters too. That's what I'm talking about. It's not the same. It's not the same when I play with my friends online, play like Halo Infinite. Like, we're having fun, but like...
It's you know, not
we're all just chatting. We're all just chatting. Yeah. We're not like trash talking enough.
Yeah. No, I love the couch co-op. I'm hoping that, you know, credit to Hazelight. I mean, they getting that Game of the Year award a couple of years ago for It Takes Two. And now following it up with a banger. I mean, Split Fiction is doing quite well. It's got over a 90 on Metacritic. Like, credit to them. Maybe we'll see a resurgence of great co-op games. I know that there's another one that came out recently that's like an obvious homage to Castle Crashers. I'll have to look up the name. But Polygon covered it recently. But I would love to see more good couch co-op games. Like, they're not a ton out there. But
was the prompt co-op, Sam? I might have missed it. You say co-op or
I just said couch multiplayer. It could be well, like, but even with couch, like, I've played Halo 3 in its entirety both online with a friend and in person with a friend. In person was way more fun.
I think even
with like the half screen, you know,
it's tough. I think co-op, that's not the prompt, but co-op, I would go online just because I'm selfish and I like seeing the full screen when I'm playing.
There's always one.
Yeah. My screen's not big enough, but that's why I'm not as good.
Competitive. I would say definitely like playing Smash Bros is that forever will take the cake. Like 8-player Smash Bros.
It's different.
Just chaos. We're doing brackets, you know, it's local brackets. It's there's something that you can't replicate just online with a friend.
If people are curious, I looked it up. The game is called Big Helmet Heroes. I haven't tried it yet.
I want to. Yeah. And I was like, I looked it up. I'm like, that looks like Castle Crashers.
Exactly. It's very, very obvious homage to Castle Crashers, cool. But it looks like.
I remember seeing that and being like, I need to tell Amanda about this, but apparently you already knew.
Yeah. Well, I know. I've got that radar down. I have a very specific range of tastes that people tend to know what I like, and I'm very vocal about it. I didn't think
you was a Castle Crashers person.
It's like you clearly haven't read my How to Get Your Girlfriend into Video Games piece, where I talk about Castle Crashers for ages.
I forgot.
I took him up years ago. No, I'm deeply fond of Castle Castle Crashers. Yeah. I think it's like a very accessible like way to bring new players in to gaming. So yeah, big fan of it. I mean, did I 100% that? No. Did I love playing it with my friends and family? Yes.
All right. Well, on that note, let's pause for another short music interlude, and we'll go back to a little outro. I imagine it's going to sound like that.
I'm just going to keep it in just like that, actually.
Okay, to wrap things up, like always, let's go around and say what we've been playing lately. So, Amanda, what have you been playing lately?
I have been playing a poor Carmen Sandiego game. I kind of went in on it on my review, which you can read online. I just finished that. I'm playing another game for a review called Expelled by Inkle. I love their games. I got to interview the story co-writer a couple years ago or last year. So yeah, I'm enjoying playing that.
Vaughn, what are you up to?
So replaying Elden Ring so I can eventually get to the, you know, Shadow of the Erdtree DLC. I started Persona 3, which, you know, could be retro. Could be. You know, could be.
It is straight up retro. Not Reload, but the old one.
Yeah, I'm playing Reload. Yeah, I feel like the one thing I'll say about the game is the difference between combat and non-combat is really stark, and I think that's got to be the, you know, system limitation, because sometimes I get bored in the non-combat, you know. I can only talk up so many girls, so many boys, so many random strangers who want to come, you know, build alignment with me. And yeah, those are my two focuses right now.
Dave?
Yeah, I just finished playing Split Fiction with my partner, Alyssa, last night. I'm writing up the review thoughts today. Spoiler or hint, it's very, very good. And after that, well, for fun, I am playing Avowed, Sam, and I dropped 3.5 hours yesterday without even realizing it.
Oh my god.
An hour of which I spent in the character creator. I was like,
hey, classic.
I love it. We've all been there.
Choosing between which hue of purple I wanted on my guy's
name.
It was like the most specific shit.
I love it in a first person game when you spend
Well, they
that
do
much
show the yeah. face. I was like, this is gonna be throwaway and I'll just have to live with that. But they showed his face and I was like, okay. All right, cool. I made the right choice. But yeah, that game is actually very fun. I can see both sides of the argument for why some people weren't as high on it. But I think the piece that you, Gary, and Clint did totally makes sense from my point of view so far. It's like it's a very fun game to play. Short ass movie, right? Short ass RPG. Well, that's what I need.
Bigger than you think. But if you do all the side quests, which
yeah,
I am doing.
Which you know I will. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been playing Avowed last couple weeks. I took a little break just because I don't want to like tire myself out on it, but I love it. I think it's really good. I've been playing an indie that's actually ties into our retro game conversation a little bit. It's in early access. I got it for like $6 on Steam, called X Zodiac. EX Zodiac. It's basically someone trying to recreate or make a new version of the old Star Fox games.
Ooh.
Like it looks like not like this, not that it, not Star Fox 64, like Star Fox on the Super Nintendo, which runs at like 8 frames a second, but like this runs at a smooth 60. It's got like a really, really a incredible color palette. Like it's a lot of like blue, purple, and pink. It's gorgeous, like polygonal art. Mechanically, it runs really smoothly. It runs a lot like that early Star Fox game. It's very much an early access game. I want to make that clear. It is not finished. It is not. You can play through the whole thing in like an hour and a half, and it's been early access for years. They add like one new level every like 3 months. So I'm really excited to see how it turns out, but that's a game I've been really enjoying.
I want to give a quick shout out to David's Game of the Year for 2024. He picked UFO 50 and he wrote a really nice piece about it and he wrote a great review. So like, as we're talking about retro inspired, just wanted to shout that out, that if people are looking for that kind of arcade style, it's a great game to check out.
Oh yeah.
Definitely. I didn't want to over talk because I feel like I talk on a lot of podcasts about that game. But yeah, if you want retro style, but in the modern era, UFO 50 is a great investment at just $25 for 50 games.
and Exodiac, the game that I was talking about.
That looked cool.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
Switch it up,
like,
Sam.
Oh, I gotta say it. Yeah.
Looks great.
Yeah, no, that's a cool thing. All right, that's it for today. For our next episodes, we'll be doing a fantasy gaming check-in. That should be a fun one. We'll see how I'm doing. Probably great. we'll also be doing an episode on difficulty in video games. Thanks once again for listening, and happy gaming.
Thank you.